one back to the other side.
So this is him?
It's not really naked. Pictures are just going crazy. Now, I don't have any more. Okay, so the topic, of course, it comes up in davening right today when we speak about in the third parsha of Shema. It says that on your fifth you should have hakanos tefilas tchelas. You should have on the corner of your garment, you should have a string of tchelas. And, of course, the tzitzis we wear today,
most of us wear,
do not have any tchelas.
They are done with completely white string, right?
I was wondering about that.
You wondering about that?
Right. So then there is, of course, on the other end, there are tchelas tzitzis, of which I brought you two samples
to show you.
There are actually the big, tremendous difference of opinion between the Ashkenazim and the Sephardim. I didn't ask it. I said, I don't know. And neither wear tzitzis, but between the Rambam and Rabbeinu Tam. I should say about how many, when it says, Hakonos Tefil Tchelet, that you're supposed to have a string of Tchelet on the corner, how many does that mean? So according to the Rambam, it means one string. By the way, to make this string, 40 snails had to die. Okay, takes 40 snails to make one string of Tchelet. Okay?
Is that half a string?
Actually, it's half a string, so it's only 20. Only 20 for this one. Right, so this is one half a string of Tchelet, right, because each, the sixth is made up of two fold strings, four strings folded over to make eight. And therefore, if one of them is blue, that means that only half the string is blue. If you have a whole string which is blue, so then you have, of course, the 40 snails, and that means you have a string on each side which is blue. This string, I think actually at home I have yet another one of these, which has yet another shita. But this is, here you have one string on each side. So you have one string on each side, which is blue. So in reality, it's the same string. The same string is folded over, and it becomes two strings, one on each side. This is called the Shita Saraivit. There's another Shita, another approach, which is Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam holds that you're supposed to have four blue strings. In other words, for each string of white, you're supposed to have a string of blue. That would mean, actually, two blue strings folded in half.
Where does he get that? How does he derive that?
I forgot. But we'll get to that eventually. Okay? I mean, right now, it didn't go over the whole share of my mind. But that's that is the approach of Rabbeinu Tam. Now, so again, as I say, this tchelos is made out of the snail you see on the page, the top page, from the top left-hand corner, the middle one is the trunculus snail, which has that nice band on it. That's the snail from which this comes. And if you look in E, you have a snail broken open, the shell is exposed, and you see the gland, the hypobranchial gland, whatever that means, which is the one gland from which the tchelos color comes. Now, it comes out clear. And we'll have to talk about that, how it becomes blue, actually, if the dye comes out clear from the snail itself. But this is only one type of tchelos that's on the market today. There's another type of tchelos called the Radziner tchelos. And the Radziner tchelos is made, it looks the same more or less, the same blue, but it's made from a cuttlefish. A cuttlefish, as we said before, is a squid. And let's just look at this a bit later. Just it feels exactly like any other tchelos is just blue. The cuttlefish is a type of squid. You have that picture on the lower left. And we're going to speak about that, about how you would make tchelos from a cuttlefish. But a cuttlefish has actually ink, which it squirts out at its enemies. I think all squids have ink, which they squirt out at their enemies. So that ink is actually black. But it can be used to make blue in a way which we're going to have to discuss and explain. Now, the question is, when tchelos stop being made? We don't know exactly when tchelos stopped being made, but it certainly was no longer extant by the end of the period of Zamorin. That means around 500, 600 Common Era, there no longer was any tchelos, at least not prevalent in the Jewish world that we know of. And in fact, there is a medrash, some obscure medrash at least, which says that the chelet has been put away until the ultimate redemption. In other words, the chelet will be revealed at the time of the ultimate redemption when Moshiach comes. And until then, there won't be chelet. Ironically enough, it's interesting that the chelet in the tzitzis is supposed to represent fear of God. And the white in the chelet is supposed to represent love of God. So you figure, if you're me at least, you figure that the fear of God or awe of God is more basic than love of God. So it seems like we're chelet should be more, I should put it, the more common substance of the two. But in fact, excuse me? Well, not being in terms of that, because Cookie said you spoke that more love than fear. But the idea is that the chelet is a much more expensive commodity. I mean, you better buy a regular pair of scissors, you know, the what we call in yeshiva, the racing stripe scissors. You know, because you have a racing stripe on the front. Mm. So you buy the regular racing stripe scissors in a store, this costs $30, right? If you buy the chelet, it costs $100. So obviously the chelet costs, it depends how many strings it costs, but $100 and up. So the question is why chelet, which represents the awe of God, actually is more rare or a rare commodity than the white, which represents the love of God. I can't really answer that question, but I can tell you that the chelet is the part of the tzitzis which is supposed to remind the person much more of the requirement to keep all the mitzvahs, because the idea of keeping mitzvahs, the idea of the tzitzis is to remind the person to keep the mitzvahs, right? You read the mitzvah, you're supposed to see Ruz Chai Ben Zkom Mitzvah Hashem, you're supposed to remember all the mitzvahs of God, and to do it, to do that. So it says, the chelet is put in the tzitzis, the rabbis say, because the chelet, the blue is like the sea, and the sea is like the sky, and the sky reminds you of God's throne, which is, so to speak, in the sky, in the heavens. So the way the chelet is supposed to remind you that there is a God in heaven, and you should do, it's recommended, that you do what he wants you to do. So that, again, I don't know exactly what chelet then was, what Haggad closely was, but the bottom line is that chelet has been gone for over 1,500 years, about 1,500 years. So now, in the early 20th century, there was a great Talmud Chacham, whose name was Rabbi Yitzhak Isaac Halevi Herzog. Rabbi Herzog, anybody know who Rabbi Herzog was?
The
father of Chaim Herzog, right, who was certainly president of the state of Israel. Rabbi Herzog was the second chief rabbi of the Jewish community in the land of Israel. He was the first chief rabbi of the newly born state of Israel. And before that, he had been chief rabbi of Ireland. And he had a doctorate from Trinity College in Dublin. And his doctorate was written on the topic of Hebrew porphology. What is Hebrew porphology? The study of Jewish purple. Porphology means purple. And purple, the study of purple. And his doctoral dissertation, which is an extraordinary, extraordinary, mind-boggling work. I plodded through it, but it's hard to say that I got through it because some of it is in French, some of it is in Greek, some of it is in Latin, right? Besides the parts in the Hebrew and English that I didn't understand. So it's, I went through it, but I didn't understand everything which I was reading. But it's an amazing work in which, the topic of which is the study of chelet, the attempt to identify the source of chelet. Okay, so that was Rabbi Herzog's thesis. Before him, and this is the major source of information which on chelet which we have. Before that, however, in the mid-1800s, there's a fellow named the Radziner Rebbe. The Radziner Rebbe, just for those of you who pursue trivia, Radziner Rebbe was the son, the grandson of the Ishbitzer Rebbe. The Ishbitzer Rebbe broke off from the Kotzker Rebbe. It's all very important, so I'll explain to you in a minute. The Kotzker Rebbe was a student of the Rebbe Rebunim of Parshitsa. The Rebbe Rebunim of Parshitsa started a new strain of Chassidus. He was like a I'm going to call him a rebel, but he was a what's the word I'm looking for?
Pre-thinker.
No.
Break-off.
Not a break-off. He was an innovative kind of fellow. That's not really the word I'm looking for. But what happened was, until the Reverend Putin came on the scene, Hasidus primarily stressed davening, singing, you know, all that kind of emotional stuff. And the Reverend Putin said, yeah, but you got to learn. And he, to a large extent, he was instrumental in getting Hasidim, or I should say at least Hasidim rabbis, to focus back on learning Torah. And his primary student was the Kotzker. And the Kotzker is, of course, famous for his fighting wit and his denigration of all things which are false or pompous or unreal. And the Kotzker was almost a forerunner of the social philosopher in that he advocated Mussar. He was so fed up with the rest of the world, as we know, that he closed himself off in a room for, I don't know, 10, 12 years and did not have anything to do with the Hasidim, even though Hasidim remained attached to him in his base medrash. So Kotzker had a student whose name was the Ishbitzer. The Ishbitzer broke off from the Kotzker, and there was a rift in Hasidus, a major rift of Hasidus for many years, and he started his own Hasidus. And the Ishbitzer is an interesting fellow. He actually was the subject of a doctoral dissertation by a scholar at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, Reform Seminary, because he's a fascinating person, not just for the Orthodox, but even for the Reform. Because he had a radical new doctrine, which is, we've discussed in the past here, but not probably most of you weren't here last time I discussed it, which is that there is no such thing as free will in terms of action. All a person has is free will in terms of the attitude he takes. Whatever happens in this world is, I should say all the time, but almost all the time, is pre-dictated by God. The question is how exactly you respond to that, or what attitude you take towards it. In other words, for example, God might have determined that yesterday you were going to sin. Yesterday you were going to sleep late and miss davening, right? But then you had a choice. When you woke up late, you could say, Gevaldik, I'm so happy I slept late because I was able to refresh myself and enjoy more time in bed. Or you could take the attitude, woe is me, it's terrible that I slept late and missed the mitzvah of coming to daven and shul. That you have free will to decide. When you got up in the morning, it might not have been free will. But afterwards, you certainly have free will how to respond. And so on and so forth. So the Ishbitzer was the wrote a technical Mashi Loach, which is an amazing paper. It's worthwhile pursuing. I don't know if Yeshiva has a copy. They probably do. And he had several great students, the greatest of which was the Reverend Tzadok of Lublin. Tzadok of Lublin, one of my personal heroes. He actually was probably the greatest Hasidic mind of all time, although tells the Hasidic he'll dispute that unless he happens to be a Hasid or Tzadok, which there are none. But he was a prolific writer. He wrote amazing, amazing stories. And he was born a non-Chassid, born a Mitznagi. It was a brilliant time of Chassid even before he became a Chassid. And his Sforim are extraordinary. They're very, very wonderful, amazing Sforim, which have tremendous insight into how the world works and how to understand how things go. And when I wrote a paper recently on Shoftim, they put out last year, so most of it was based on Rav Tzadok HaKohen. And when one learns of Tzadok, one enters a different universe. The professor of Jewish studies at Brooklyn College, his name is Schneer Lyman, a very well-known scholar. He said, were Tzadok ever translated to English, it would revolutionize the world of philosophy.
Is your book in English?
No. So Tzadok is very hard to translate. It's not so clear that it can be translated. He was an amazing, amazing Talmud Chacham, who was the focal thinker in Hasidus, as far as many people are concerned. So besides that, the Ishbitzer had his son. His name was the Beit Yaakov. And the Ishbitzer had his grandson, who's actually the one who put together the Me'ah Shiloh, the grandfather's sefer, who was Gershon Hanoch Henoch Leiner of Radin. And he was the Ratzinger Rebbe. And he was a tremendous Talmud Chacham. He didn't live very long. He died in the 50s. He was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, a great scholar. a very deep thinker. He put out amazing books. And he decided he's going to find the Kalis. He decided that enough is enough. We need to have the Kalis in order to go, in order to have the Geula, in order to restore the Beit HaMikdash and have Korbanos, we have to have the garments of a Kohen. So therefore, we need to find the Kalis. So what did the Radziner do? It's amazing thing. He would never expect the rabbi to do this. He traveled to Italy. And he went, I don't know where, remember where the Great Aquarium is, but he went wherever the Great Aquarium is in Italy, and he studied the fish. He went from fish to fish to fish, studying the properties to see how he can identify, if he can identify which one was the fish from which the Tchelos was taken, because we know the Tchelos was taken from a fish called the Chibla Zone. You want to call it the Chibla Zone, which is not necessarily a Hebrew word. It's probably the Persian word. And in Persian, actually, although I don't know if the Radziner knew this, it's the critical later on, the word Chibla Zone in Persian means snail. So, that's going to be important to us later on, obviously. So it's actually like a snail or a worm, one of those types of creatures, but I think it's actually a snail, not a worm. But in any event, so the Radina came to the conclusion that it was the cuttlefish. The cuttlefish, this fish you have pictured on the front here. And the reason he came to this conclusion is because he gave the ink of the cuttlefish to a chemist. Obviously, I'm sure it went through many different substances. And the chemist was able to produce a blue dye from the black ink of the cuttlefish. And he was convinced, based on evidence which he mustered, that the cuttlefish was therefore the source of Tchelos. And Radziner Chassidim, to this day, not that many Radziner Chassidim, but the Breslovers, for some reason which I don't understand, adopted the Radziner custom. So Breslovers, also many of them wear Tchelos. The Tchelos which they wear comes from the cuttlefish. It's the same color, but it comes from this ink. It doesn't come from the snail, which we're going to speak about later. Now, one of the things that I heard about David when he wrote his doctoral thesis is that he wrote a letter, this was before the Second World War, he wrote a letter, way before, so the 1920s, I think, he wrote a letter to one of the Radziner Hasidim, wherever they live, and the Radziner Chassid wrote back to him the process and sent his thesis how they made this playlist. In fact, after the Second World War, many of the Radziner Hasidim were killed. Obviously, there are Polish Hasidim, like all Polish Hasidim, they were decimated. The only way they were able to retrieve the process of how to make their own chelos was to go to Rabbi Herzog. And I guess from Rabbi Herzog, the letter describing how the process took place. The thing is, that Rabbi Herzog took this letter and the process to a chemist. He came to the amazing discovery that whoever the chemist was that the Radziner employed could read it. Because the dye which comes from the cuttlefish is Prussian blue. Prussian blue is an artificial dye which was first synthesized sometime in the 18th century. And the way Prussian blue works is if you put these chemicals, I forget whatever they are, they're colorless chemicals though, if you put them into any organic source, anything which has, I guess, proteins in it, so it would I think that that's what most organisms have, proteins. So that, what? Nobody knows here? Something.
I know about space, not...
Okay. So in any event, so you put it to any organic source, they used to use ox blood in the old days, but you put it to any organic source, that would make blue. It's not that the blood is the blue, but rather the chemicals create the blue, and it doesn't matter what color or what source the blood and whatever chemicals were in the blood or whatever organic material used come from. So therefore, Rabbi Herzog came to the conclusion that Rabbi Weiner was hoodwinked, that he was told that this blue was the product of the cuttlefish. It wasn't. It was the product of the chemicals which were added to the cuttlefish ink, and he couldn't use any other color in order to get that. Now, since that is the case, you would expect that the Radziner Chassidim would have given up the practice of weighing less units famous. And you expect that, you wouldn't know, you don't know a thing about Hasidim. The reason Hasidim do many things that they do is because the Rebbe did it. It doesn't really matter why the Rebbe did it. The fact is that the Rebbe did it. And therefore, since the Rebbe wore Chelis from the cuttlefish, so therefore to this very day they wear the Chelis from the cuttlefish, and they haven't switched over to the modern Chelis, so to speak, made from the manure to try to a female. The question which also writes, the base question before we begin, is what does it hurt to wear Chelis? In other words, why should, let's assume that they're wrong, because Razina is wrong, let's assume that the modern scientists who claim that it's from the New York Strunculus are wrong. But the question is, what does it hurt to wear Chelis? So this is not an easy question to answer, because it would seem that, you know, you can color your scissors any color. If you are really, you know, you're a hip kind of guy, you want to color your scissors red and wear red scissors, so everybody's going to think you're weird. But you're going to fulfill them as systems. It really doesn't matter what color your systems are, right?
Yeah,
red, green, yellow,
rainbow.
You can do anything you want, you know, whatever terms you want. But that added, so therefore, what would be the problem of having the blue, even if it wasn't the right color?
Even Crayola.
Right, in Crayola, right. And that's, there are many people who say it, and among them, the Razina, who said, what do you got to lose? Why not use my trailers, right? There's nothing wrong. As the worst comes to worst, disregard is no color. You don't lose anything. And it's said that Razina went to Yitzchak Elchanan. Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who was the Rav of Kovno, died 1892, was the preeminent posek, the greatest halachic authority of his generation. And he asked Yitzchak Elchanan to wear chelis because it doesn't hurt. And Yitzchak Elchanan said, you know, really, I would wear chelis. It's an interesting insight. He says, really, I would wear chelis. I don't know if it's the right chelis or not the right chelis. Maybe it's the right, maybe it's the wrong, I don't know. But, you're right, it wouldn't hurt for me to wear chelis. Except that I am one of the major halachic authorities of this generation. If I start putting on chelis, there are definitely going to be some people who think I've gone out of my mind. Right, because people don't like new things and they find it to be strange and questionable. So therefore, my authority in other areas where it's important for me to retain that authority would be undermined by my putting on a chelis.
You didn't see the flip side, that everyone would start wearing it?
No, that doesn't work that way in Judaism. It really doesn't. If you come up, see, there's a difference. If you come up in Judaism with something not to do, then people will follow suit relatively quickly. But if you come up with something that people should do, it doesn't work that way. So the especially costs lots of money. So the idea of putting on the chelis, which he said, would theoretically not hurt, except for the fact that people look askance and not accept my rulings when it came to other areas, and therefore he felt it was not expedient for him to put on chelis. The fact that Razina was regarded by many people in his generation as someone as an eccentric for going around promoting this cause, which didn't seem to be pressing to very many people at the time. So, you know, Yitzchak Elchanan kind of said not to have put on chelis. There's an interesting view, which really I should leave for much later on in the discussion, but I'm going to make it clear today, which is said in the name of the Beit HaLevi. The Beit HaLevi was contemporary of the Razina. The Beit HaLevi was, the rabbi was first in Rosh Hashiva in Volozhin, and then he was the rabbi in Brisk. And his name was Rabbi Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. And he was the progenitor of the famous Soloveitchik family. No, there was Soloveitchik before him, but he was the most original one as far as we're concerned. And his son was Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the most famous of the Soloveitchiks. And then his grandson, the Reb Chaim, Reb Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, Beit HaLevi's great grandson, was Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was in Yeshiva University in Boston. And there are many Soloveitchiks around the world today who are descended from the Beit HaLevi. So the Beit HaLevi was also approached by the Razina. And he said a fascinating thing. He said, and this is a very important fundamental principle, he said, you cannot, there's certain things in Judaism which you cannot decide on the basis of evidence. You have to have a Masorah as to what they are. Masorah means a tradition, a chain of tradition. In other words, how do we know that an S-robe is an S-robe? We really have no way of knowing that an S-robe, you know, the Citron is an S-robe. We know because we have a chain of tradition going back, an unbroken chain going back year after year after year, back to whenever, and they use Citrons all the time. How do we know that filling is supposed to be square? Doesn't say the Torah is supposed to be square, but we have an unbroken chain of tradition going back. The problem with reinstating many of the things which were lost is that it's hard to do that, if not impossible to do that, without Masoret. No matter how much proof and evidence you muster, since there's nothing more than circumstantial evidence, so that you will never be able to accomplish the validity of a Masoret. And think about it, all of Judaism is really based on the concept of the Masoret, of the tradition which is passed from generation to generation to generation. So the debate that lady was the opinion that it undermined the entire concept of Masoret to be able to take something out of nowhere and make it a standard, you know, a benchmark of Jewish observance. This actually is interesting, the issue which came up in the past few weeks in Israel. As they discovered, most of the meat in Israel comes from South America. Most of the red meat comes from South America, from Argentina. No, not Argentina, Uruguay. It used to be Argentina. I think it comes from Uruguay. And they discovered, quote unquote discovered, or a few weeks ago, it's a big scandal now in Israel, that most of the cows which are slaughtered in whatever it is, Argentina, Uruguay, are actually not cows, but zebus. Zebus, it seems, are a variant of the cow family. They look like cows, except they have a hump on their back. Now, I have not seen a picture. I'm sure you can find a picture of
them. Oh, yeah, I know that, actually.
I thought you only know about outer space.
No, anything in Simpsons also.
Anything what?
Anything mentioned in the Simpsons. That was mentioned.
A great question.
A Hebrew, yes.
Yeah.
It's like a mouse, but it has a hump and a dewlap.
Sure.
I don't know what a dewlap is, but it's on the bottom.
Why would that be mentioned in the Simpsons?
He's trying to teach the baby to be smart or something. How did you make it?
Okay. Obviously, this is a great source of knowledge for you. I should really start watching the Simpsons. So the zebu, it seems, is not specifically precisely cow. It can be bred with cow. They you can mate a cow with a zebu, but it isn't precisely a cow. So the question is, if you don't have a masoira on the zebu specifically, and you say, well, it actually looks like a cow, it chews its cud like a cow, it looks like a cow, it can breed with a cow, isn't it a cow? And the answer is not necessarily. The odds are that it's a cow, but we don't know with certainty. So the truth is that the zebu, it may well be close enough, and also, it's not clear that we need a specific masoret, a specific tradition, by animals. Because animals is a relatively easy way to identify whether they're kosher or not, which is see if they chew their cud, and have squiggles. But by birds, there is a major problem. By birds, there is a great problem as to why Jews are allowed to eat turkey. Because, the Gemara says, there really is no specific trait which you can identify as being in common among kosher birds, or conversely, in common among non-kosher birds. Generally speaking, the Gemara says the rule of thumb is that if a bird has an extra claw in the back of its hand, whatever it's called, extra talon in the back of its claw, thank you. So then, it's a trait bird. Why is that? Because it means it's a predator. And generally speaking, the predator birds are the not kosher ones, whereas the not predator birds are the kosher ones.
Pigeons are kosher?
Yeah, pigeons are kosher. They sacrifice them to make them.
Canaries.
I'm not saying, you shouldn't take pigeons off the streets of New York and slaughter them. That would not be advisable. But yes, pigeons are kosher birds, certainly. I think a quail is a type of pigeon, which actually is illegal. You can't find Wesley kosher somewhere like that, but they do have it in certain places, in various places. So in any event, so the question is, well, okay, there is a Masoret for chickens, right? There's a tradition going back, an unbroken chain to the Gemara that chickens are chickens. But they didn't have turkeys in the old world. Turkeys are an invention of the new world. They only came across turkeys when they first came to America, right? Everybody know that?
Mm-hmm.
There are no turkeys before 1492. I mean, maybe they existed here in the theoretical existential sense. But, as far as we're concerned, turkeys only came into existence in 1492 when Columbus discovered America. Yet, it's interesting because in Hebrew, the name for turkey is?
Turkey?
Somebody know? Hodu. Where does Hodu come from? India. Right? I don't know how the name became turkey in English. But in, it's also Indian, because if, when Columbus came and he discovered that we are all the Indians, and he calls people here Indians. So therefore logic dictates that that bird is an Indian bird. So it's called Tamigold Hodu. That's what it's called. So the question is, how are we allowed to eat turkey? And the answer is, we really don't know what about teacher. We understand that it is similar enough to the chicken that, you know, similar to the chicken that we assume that it is like a chicken. And also, well, it's interesting, I just saw this written up, I think, yesterday somewhere, that by the time the rabbi started talking about turkey, many Jews have started eating turkey. Lots and lots of them. So it'd be very, very difficult to turn around and say, well, you know, all you guys have been sinners all these years, and go and kosher out your pops. So this is it was very difficult to come to that conclusion, and as a result, turkey has made it, and turkey is in fact a major staple of the Jewish diet today. It's an interesting thing, there are still people who don't eat turkey. There are Jews who don't eat turkey. It's interesting to observe Yaakov Kamenetsky. Yaakov Kamenetsky was married twice, his first wife died very young. His first wife was of Lithuanian descent, his second wife was of Hasidic descent. And his second wife, and their family, they didn't eat turkey. You know, because there was no Masorah, no tradition on turkey. So therefore, when he married his second wife, till then he was eating turkey, but then he stopped, out of respect for his wife's family. And the Kamenetsky family, to this very day, even his children who weren't from his second wife, they're all from his first wife. They don't eat turkey, because since their father accepted, out of respect for his second wife, not to eat turkey, they stopped eating turkey too. So there are definitely Jews to this very day who don't eat turkey. And there are Jews, if you go to be kosher nowadays, you'll see that there's buffalo, there's bison meat. Bison meat is much cheaper than regular roast beef. It's very good at the moment. And I think it's supposed to be healthier also. And the question is, of course, buffalo also didn't exist in the old world. It's also discovered by Columbus. I don't know where the name buffalo comes from. I don't think it comes from the city. But the buffalo also became accepted as a kosher food, again, because it's soon to be close enough to a cow or not. You go out to look on the bulletin board there with the program they're going to have the OUs running in next month in May, and 2 months. In May, in fact, they would like to go to, which they're going to have a discussion. One of the discussions they're going to have is, how do we know that, why was the OU's policy, how has become the OU's policy to set buffalo as a kosher meat?
Well, no, venison.
Excuse me? Venison. Venison was always there. Yeah, it was always there.
Do you have a story for deer?
What?
Do you have a story for giraffe?
No.
Deer. We don't have a chef giraffe
for giraffe. Yeah, okay,
deer. Stop.
No. We can chef giraffe. They're endangered species. Nobody can eat that. Nobody eats that.
Yeah, but do we have a story for eating them? Like, can we eat them? Could we do that?
That's the thing. According to most posting, you don't need a Masorah by animals which have chewed their cud and have cloven hooves.
So we can eat giraffe.
You can eat giraffe. It's really the birds which are more of a problem. So therefore, yeah, you could eat giraffe.
What's a giraffe? Red listed.
Deer also, deer is kosher. Around the deer is, and you can buy venison. There is a kosher venison farm in upstate New York. But the problem is that unless they're semi-domesticated, at least, it's very hard to catch a deer to slaughter it. No, cows are big, it's stupid mess. Right.
You can't shoot the deer in the...
Right.
I've had venison.
Yeah?
It's good.
It's good, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a salt deer.
What about duck?
Duck is kosher. Goose is kosher.
We have a Masorah for ducks and goose.
All these things we have a Masorah for. Yeah.
Okay.
But all these things exist in the old world.
How about when bees and swans, they are almost the same family? But swan is not kosher and goose.
Maybe there's not a Masorah on swans. I don't know. Maybe there's not a Masorah on swans. That was generally... There's somewhere along the line, obviously, there's a cutoff point.
So for birds, we need a Masorah for other things we don't.
Right. Another thing which you need in Masorah is grasshoppers.
Locusts.
The Sephardim eat locusts. Yeah, they do. But the Ashkenazim don't eat locusts. because we hold the need of the Torah on locusts, because it's hard to differentiate, at least to the uninitiated, between a kosher locust and a non-kosher locust. So therefore, well, fine if they do eat locusts, because they have a Torah, but really amazing that they decide that they decide to eat locusts, but Ashkenazim do not eat locusts, again, because we don't have a Torah. Interesting. Now, lucky question. Let's say you invite over to the house of a Sephardi for dinner, and he's eating locusts. Are you allowed to participate in the locust meal with him? Okay.
Yes.
You've
never had
to face it,
sir.
I don't know.
I've never had to face it. It's a Torah. You can eat it. I've never seen it sold anywhere.
Go together.
I don't think there's much of a market for it. It's on the books. You see, we're used to thinking that Jews can eat meat, chicken, turkey. Right, that's basically if you go to the supermarket, what you find. But Philly food is a much richer religion than that. So that's a lot more stuff to eat, just you have to go out and find it and slaughter it.
It's all food-based, so I mean, figure that out that we noticed that.
What?
Judaism's very food-based. There's a lot.
Yeah, but the availability of the other food is not so easy to get. They're actually, at the end, if you look at that, invitation on the wall there, on your bulletin board behind you, you'll see that they're going to have at the end of that day on May 2nd, for those who want to go after all the shiurim to Havana in New York City, for $161, on which they're not making money. That's cost. You can get the dinner, because they're going to serve a dinner with all these exotic meats, which normally Jews don't have access to because they're not available. Venison, quail, I don't know if they're serving giraffe. I don't know what else they're serving. There's a list of things they're serving there. So the
should fund that for us.
Yeah, $161. So all this comes back to Kalis, and we'll come on. This will have to finish just giving an overview tomorrow, get in greater detail. But the question is, at what point does something cross the threshold where you can reinstitute it, so to speak, even if you're a Mesorah? And there are other things like that, which are necessary as precursors for the building of the Beit HaMikdash. For example, Paraduma. Well, how do we know the Paraduma? There are many red cows, right? Paraduma is a red heifer, which you kill, you slaughter, and then you burn it, and you take the ashes, and you sprinkle it on anybody who's impure, so maybe pure again. So there are many red cows. It's not as if it's an extinct breed. They exist all over the place. But who knows what red is red, right? You know, how do you define the red, which is the red necessary for a red cow? So that's why the rabbis say, Eliyahu HaNavi's role in bringing the redemption is critical. Why is Eliyahu HaNavi, the Rambam writes, why is Eliyahu HaNavi important? He's more important than Mashiach. Why is that? Because Eliyahu HaNavi is going to restore all the traditions which have been lost. Eliyahu HaNavi goes back to the first Beit HaMikdash when everything was known. Before things start being forgotten, the time of the first Golos of Babel, and he restores all those traditions. So Yo's role is to bring back all of these traditions which we have lost, and that authentically, beyond the shadow of a doubt, and that will be a necessary precursor to the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. Okay, so again, we'll get into the proofs and evidence tomorrow, but I'll play those back and forth, but that's it for today.
Let's give me a few seconds.